So as you can see, there's a lot we can discuss about the topic water quality. There's a lot of approaches we can take. And we've compiled a panel that we think will do a good job at helping us understand this. Over here at the end, we have Rusty Rosell. He manages Mecklenburg County's water quality program. And this office has the task of maintaining and restoring the quality and usability of the county's surface water resources, including the lakes that provide Charlotte's drinking water. Mr. Rosell's staff performs water quality monitoring, enforces stormwater permits, and works to identify and eliminate sources of water pollution. And next to Mr. Rosell, we have Rick Gaskins. He's the executive director of the Catawba Riverkeeper Foundation. The organization advocates for the health, protection, and enjoyment of the Catawba River watershed. Mr. Gaskins has also served in the role of Catawba River Keeper. And before joining the foundation, he worked for 24 years as an environmental attorney in private practice. He's a previous chairman of the Environmental Law Society at Harvard. And we also, next to me, have Joe Padilla. He is the executive director of the Real Estate and Building Industry Coalition. And this trade association promotes public policies that encourage smart economic growth and job creation in Charlotte. The coalition advocates for the interests of realtors, home builders, commercial developers, and brokers. And Mr. Padilla is the current chair of Mecklenburg County's Small Business and Entrepreneurial Advisory Board. And at the end here, we have Barry Gullett. He's the director of utilities for CMUD. That's the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Utility Department. His career with the department has included positions as a civil engineer, assistant chief engineer, and deputy director. Among his roles at CMUD have been management of water treatment and wastewater operations. Mr. Gullett is the current chair of the Catawba Watery Water Management Group. So thank you, all of you, for joining us this evening. And I wanted to start off by starting with you, Mr. Rosell, and asking, so how does our water quality...
Rusty, please tell me.
All right. So, Rusty, how does our water quality in Mecklenburg County rate?
Well, it's not as bad as it could be, but it's not as good as it should be. Maybe that's a good way to put it.
Isn't that a country song?
It should be if it isn't. But... you know, there are areas of Mecklenburg County that do have some water quality problems that are fairly significant. And we mentioned earlier, talked earlier about water quality standards, the federal and the state standards, and the state monitors about 300 miles of streams in Mecklenburg County, and they monitor it for compliance with their standards. And if they, a certain percentage of their analyses don't meet their standard, they consider it to be impaired. So of those 300 miles, about 72 to 74% are impaired.
And what's doing the impairment?
The primary source of the impairment is stormwater runoff.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Gaskins, do you agree with that assessment as far as our water quality?
Well, as was alluded to earlier, you know, I would contend everything in the basin is impaired because of mercury. There are all waters under the Clean Water Act are supposed to be fishable, a potential source of drinking water, and swimmable. And because of the mercury advisories, which are throughout the state for fish, arguably the entire state, all the waters in the state, including all the waters in Mecklenburg County, don't meet federal standards because they're not fishable. So, you know, you could make an argument that it's 100% failure rate. But even, you know, 70%, 80%, whatever number you want to come up with, it's still, if your child brought home a 20 on their exam or a 30 on their exam, you wouldn't be very happy with them.
And, so, and you're nodding your head as well, so.
I think there's merit to what he's saying, sure. But according to state law, state standards, the percentage is about 74% of the monitored miles. But all waters, not just in Mecklenburg County, but all across the country, if not the world, most water does have some contaminant in it. Even the most remote places of Alaska have water contaminants carried there through precipitation. So water is polluted all across the world.
And much of that mercury comes from burning coal.
I think the estimates are roughly 80% of the mercury comes one way or another from burning coal, basically going into the atmosphere, coming down to the ground, reacting, forming methyl mercury, which is what is actually biologically taken up into the ecosystem. And so mercury is a real problem. The state epidemiologist estimates that in North Carolina, about 16,667 children a year have lifelong learning disabilities from eating fish with mercury in them. And, you know, incidentally, and Rusty's probably had the same experience, when I'm out in our boat, I like to stop and talk to the fishermen, particularly the ones fishing under the bridges and near the hot holes from the power plants, who are usually the ones who are really fishing to put food on the plate at home. And I'll say, do you know about the fish advisories? And they'll say, you know, sometimes they'll say, yeah, I know about them. And I say, so you're planning to keep that fish you have in your bucket there, because that's one of the covered fish. And they say, oh, no, no, no. I'm kind of thinking, why are you keeping the fish in your bucket if you're not going to take it home and eat it? And a lot of these people are feeding their families 4 or 5 days a week with fish out of the Catawba River. So that is a concern, because it affects all of us having less productive members of society because of this exposure.
So we heard runoff is a major factor in pollution in this area's rivers, and that includes basically, you know, the runoff from your driveways, from parking lots. There's a lot of development going on in this area, and that's part of the reason there's so much runoff. And Mr. Padilla, you are, you know, the groups you represent are building the homes we want to live in, building the shopping malls where we shop. What do you think the role of builders and developers should be in making sure that is clean water or somewhat clean water that is running off from property or filtered into wastewater?
Well, anyone who makes a living in real estate in Mecklenburg County or anywhere has a huge stake in the quality of the water, the quality of the air, the quality of our natural environment in every sense, because that's what they sell. You know, our home builders are selling quality of life in Mecklenburg County. We're selling parks. We're selling the canopy. We're selling everything that is threatened by bad water quality, by, you know, streams that are impaired or undrinkable, or you can't fish. So there is an inherent need to focus on that. And at the same time, I think the regulation that's on our industry is significant. And one of the things that I frequently look at, which, you know, surprised me the first time I looked at, but even EPA will recognize, as they look at the contaminants nationally in streams, most of it, in fact, I would say, conversely, very little of it is actually coming from construction runoff. Only about 0.15% as of EPA report in 2009 showed comes from construction runoff. And that's quite frankly because we have very good regulations in place. There are regulations on everything from the construction of homes to construction of commercial buildings, whether it's an office tower or a retail center. Everything from the stream buffers, 35 feet on either side of a stream that you can't get near. You've got regulations on...
And when you say construction runoff, you mean the actual building, not necessarily the runoff once you have the new development.
Right.
You have the parking lots in place, not not that runoff.
Even that runoff, I believe the EPA only estimates that about 5 to 7% of the total runoff going into a stream is coming from what they call urban runoff. But not that that's insignificant by any means. But the regulation that is on development today, now certainly wasn't there in 1960, 1970, a lot of the older sites were built, but the regulation that's on development and construction today is significant. And I think if it's monitored and if it's complied with the way it's intended, it does do a very good job of keeping sediment out of creeks and streams, because there is just a myriad of regulation from the federal level all the way down to the local level to address that. And that's where the balance comes in of how much more regulation is needed versus how much additional cost goes into every home, every business, how many jobs may then migrate further out to counties or communities with less stringent regulation. So it's a balance. We absolutely need to prioritize environmental protection, but we also need to prioritize affordable housing. We need to prioritize job growth and job creation as well.
So where specifically do you strike that balance? I mean, as far as Mecklenburg County, is it a good balance we're striking here? As far as you're concerned with development, are there places that we could be more stringent on? Are there places that we could be more lax on? I mean, what is the appropriate place as far as you're concerned that would preserve water quality in the area and also make it a good place to develop?
You know, I think what we need to look at right now is there isn't a lot of land left in Mecklenburg County. There isn't a lot of what we call greenfield left in Mecklenburg. Most of our county is developed out. Certainly, most of the city of Charlotte is developed out. So what we need to look at are how do we find ways to incentivize and encourage redevelopment? How do we find ways of making sure that rather than encouraging a developer to go out and find a greenfield piece that is a county away or undeveloped today and contributing to healthy water quality, can we incentivize that developer to look at a piece of property in the city that's already paved, already developed, and maybe underutilized? And if we can find ways to do that, then I think we make a significant dent. Now, I think we have to also be aware that redevelopment is very expensive. Redevelopment is, from a land price situation, is often higher because you're dealing with developed property closer into the city, closer into the urban core. The cost of redeveloping is much higher than going out and doing a greenfield property. But if we can find ways to incentivize, and I think the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County are certainly looking at some ways to do that, but I think that's the next step that we need to look at. How do we encourage projects and development to stay in the urban core rather than continuing to, so to say, sprawl outward?
And I'm sure we'll return to the subject later on. But on to you, Mr. Gullett. As far as when we've been talking before, you said, you know, kind of your water quality from a drinking standpoint has a lot to do with the water quality in the river to begin with. So how would you rate the quality of the drinking water or the quality of the water we're taking from Mountain Island Lake and Lake Norman? Is it fit to produce good drinking water?
Yes, it is. It actually produces quite good drinking water. Obviously, the better, the higher quality raw water that you start with, raw water being the water directly from the reservoirs, the higher that quality of water, the easier it is to treat, and the better quality you're going to wind up with in the end. So it's very important that we take care of those resources and keep them as clean as possible. But right now, the lakes, they produce very, very good drinking water. People need to remember that water plants are designed to take things out of water. And so if you look at water supply sources across the whole country or across the whole world, you'll see water treatment plants dealing with everything from pristine mountain streams to some of the most polluted rivers in the world. And in each case, you know, drinking water plants can treat that and can produce drinking water. It might be more costly. It might be more complex. And the quality of the finished product may not be as good. But it can be done. The treatment plants are designed to do that. Now, in Charlotte and Mecklenburg, we believe it's important to protect the quality of the raw water in the lakes so that we start with that highest quality water that we can and that we provide the best quality treatment, the highest levels of technology, the most reliable operation, the most careful testing and certification of the safety of the water. We believe all those things are important. We believe that the quality of the drinking water in Charlotte-Mecklenburg right now is excellent. In fact, when we do more than 150,000 tests per year of the drinking water, not only at the treatment plant, but we go out into the system to people's faucets and collect water from the same places that people are using it from. We do that every day of the week. and we bring that water back to the laboratory and test it to be sure that it still complies with the standards. And in the beginning, there was a statement made that we're shooting for those minimum requirements, and I want to make a little bit of a correction to that. That's actually not what we're shooting for. We're shooting for something that's much better than those minimum requirements for several reasons. First is that the minimum requirements protect safety and health, but they don't necessarily provide the best product. And so we have treatment plants that are capable of doing better, and we believe they should do better, and that's our standard that we set internally, is to far exceed those minimum standards.
Now, just real quickly, you know, we're hearing that, you know, a lot of parts of the Catawba, the water quality is impaired. So how is it that we have good water quality taken out of our Mountain Island Lake and Lake Norman?
Yeah, the impairments are of certain parameters, and those are parameters that we can deal with the water treatment system. And so so people talk about risk to the Catawba River and to water bodies in particular. So there are a lot of risk there to the raw product that could impact the finished product. And that's where careful monitoring, that's where a lot of diligence on the part of the public to understand the connections between storm drain basins and the lake and the water quality in the lakes and the rivers exist, and to help us, you know, be sure that people aren't putting things in where they shouldn't be. That if there are septic tanks that are failing on the banks of the lake or the river, that gets reported and gets dealt with and gets repaired if it's yours, so that the water quality is protected and we start with that good product.
Well, thank you. And before I open this to the audience for questions, just real quickly, does anyone have a brief follow-up to what was said here?
I'd like to respond to a couple of things Mr. Padilla said, and I could go on for a while, but maybe I'll start where we agree. I think we agree that a good, clean environment is good for development, it's good for business, it's good for home builders. People would rather live in a neighborhood that's got greenways and clean streams and has a healthy environment. So I think we're in total agreement there. I think where we would disagree is, you know, is what's being done now and are the existing laws adequate to protect the environment? And I would strongly disagree. I could take everybody on a bus tour and show you streams that are either totally scoured out from stormwater, streams that are full of sediment. You can look in satellite photos coming into Mountain Island Lake, and you can see all the sediment coming in from McDowell Creek into Mountain Island Lake from development activity. So it's visible on a macro scale or a micro scale, and it's a big problem. And in the clay particles in particular carry a lot of other contaminants with them. A lot of things like to attach to those clay particles. So it is a real problem. The existing laws, Mecklenburg County has better laws than most of the state, but it's still not quite enough. And I get calls every day, particularly this last weekend. I probably had 60 calls about sediment problems. And in most cases, I have to tell people, unfortunately, from what you're describing, it appears that this builder is complying with the law. And what they're doing is legal, or at least it is not the type of thing that they would take an enforcement action to stop. And so, I could show you pictures. There's a classic development up on Lake Norman called Burton Creek, where a developer came pretty darn close to complying with the law. They kept their buffers, they had sediment ponds, they had silt fences, and yet they put feet of sediment into a cove on Lake Norman. So I do think it's a problem. I do think the laws are inadequate. And I think where we might even agree is we need to change the law to incentivize the right kind of development. The solution is smarter development. We've basically got zoning laws that were developed in the 60s, and they don't fit what we need today. And right now it's harder for a developer to do the right kind of development because they got to get a variance than to do a cookie-cutter development that really creates a lot of infrastructure, stormwater, sediment problems. So I'll stop there. But
so in some ways, you're arguing for smarter regulations.
I'm arguing for incentives to create the right kind of development. And you know, and I have to say, you know, we try to get the word out. We are not against development, and I will gladly go arm in arm with a developer to get a variance to do higher density on a project in most cases, as long as they give bigger buffers, protect the greenways along the waterways, and do that thing. And I think it makes a community that's more livable and will sell better and will fetch a higher price on the market. So the problem is it takes time. You got to go through the zoning process.
In solving the problem, it's going to be extremely difficult and extremely expensive. And I don't think people really understand the magnitude of it. For example, every car on the road, you know, steel belted radial tires, and they've got brake pads. And these tires are wearing down, as are the brake pads, and you're depositing a gray dust on the side of the road that contains metals, a lot of iron, a lot of magnesium, and it rains. And all of that material is picked up, carried in that runoff, put into a storm drain, those grates in the curbs, and is dumped straight into a creek. And fertilizers on lawns. If you fertilize your lawn anywhere near a rain event, most of your fertilizer is going to end up in a creek. A lot of people dump motor oil in storm drains, or we see a lot of people that dump paint into storm drains. That's obviously a significant pollution problem. Every car that drips oil in a parking lot, every antifreeze drip, anything that is deposited on the surface of the ground or in a parking lot, when it rains, it's going to be carried to a pipe and straight to a creek. And when you understand the magnitude of that, it's almost mind-boggling. And probably, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but we didn't even start regulating these pollutants until 2007, 2008.
When you say we, you mean Mecklenburg County.
Mecklenburg County.
Yeah.
Now, we had some regulations for development in the areas that drain straight to Mountain Island Lake and our drinking water reservoirs as far back as 1994. But that's only about a tenth or less of the surface area of the county. For the rest of the nine-tenths of the county, a lot of this has never been regulated. So when you walk and leave here tonight and you look at all the impervious surface around you here in downtown Charlotte, all of that, along with all the pollutants in it, goes straight to the creek. But it's even more than that. That's just the pollution piece of it. There's also something we call volume and velocity associated with stormwater, and this is how that looks. If you take an acre of trees in Mecklenburg County and you rain an inch on top of it, that raindrop will hit the leaf on that tree, settle slowly down to the forest floor, and soak into the ground and go into groundwater. And groundwater is important because that gives us recharge during drought, which we just went through not too long ago. That recharges groundwater and filters out a lot of the pollutants contained in the atmosphere. If you cut those trees down and put down an acre of asphalt, that same 1 inch of rain puts 27,000 gallons of water in the creek, straight to a pipe and straight into a creek. And that natural system is just in shock by all this added water that's moving really fast. In the summer, it's really hot. So you're scouring out the stream banks, you're scouring out the bottom, you're destroying aquatic habitat, and you're really destroying creeks. And if you look at most of our creeks here in Mecklenburg County, they're deep, have vertical banks that have been cut away, and that's why. All this volume and velocity of water that is just totally, for the most part, unmanaged, and destroying our creek systems. And so how do you fix it? Well, you have to install devices to collect this storm water, to slow it down, to address that added volume and velocity, and also to filter out those pollutants so that what you end up with running into your creek and your surface waters is as close as possible as we can get to natural conditions. Because the stream channel is natural. It's been that way. It was formed that way through natural processes. Our urban environment is unnatural, and they conflict. And it's a very, very big dilemma, because the cost of going into, let's say, downtown Charlotte and retrofitting all these water quality and quantity, volume control devices is millions, if not billions, of dollars countywide.
Because they were built a long time ago.
That's right.
When
they
you
were
didn't
built,
even have
that's
a,
right.
a stormwater system.
That's exactly
where you had
right.
rains.
And most
so.
Of the impervious area in Mecklenburg County, we didn't even start regulating volume and velocity till 79. And that was only for commercial development. For single family and residential development, we didn't regulate it in greater Mecklenburg County until 2008. So you've had all of this hard surface that's been put down with no controls. So how do you go back in to an urban environment and put in the devices that have to have area, and you're talking about land values measured in, you know, cost per square foot, and you've got to take up a considerable amount of room to pond or collect these waters and treat it. So it's pretty depressing to me, I got to be honest with you.
And I know it's depressing to Mr. Padilla, too.
And I keep hoping for some really smart scientists to come along and figure out something you can put in a pipe, you know, to retrofit and fix it. But we're going to have to figure that out some way in order to address these issues.
But let me say this. I mean, in a way, the other side of that is we're doing such a bad job right now with stormwater that there's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there. So there are a lot of things, you know, at our houses we can do to limit the stormwater coming off our
sure.
property. So we can create a depression on our property, plant a few plants there. We give it a fancy name of a rain garden. And that will help control the pollutants coming off my driveway and my roof by collecting it there. We can collect stuff in a rain barrel and use it on our garden. And it's pretty low-tech. It's cheap. It makes a difference. If we had 800,000 people in Mecklenburg County doing that, that would make a big difference to stream quality. So there are a lot of really low-hanging, easy things that can be done. And I have to thank, actually, CMUD. They came out and fixed a water pipe and ended up not grading my yard very well, and they created a nice depression. So I now have a rain garden in my yard. So thank you, Barry.
Well, I have a feeling we're going to circle back to this a little bit more and get more into the sort of patchwork of agencies and regulations that folks are looking at. But I wanted to open the conversation to all of you in the audience. I hope you've come with a lot of questions, input. We have two people with microphones, two WFAE staff members. Aaron over here and Tina over there, and they would love to start taking questions. So we'll start over here. And if you could also introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm David Robinson from the Sierra Club. I've got a question about impervious asphalt, and there's a year or so ago in the papers there was a lot of discussion about Browns Cove and the construction project that took place near there and all of the sediment that was washing into it to fill it up. And a lot of people at Browns Cove were very unhappy about the prospect of Browns Cove filling up. So what I'm curious about is, can the county of Mecklenburg or the city do anything to start using pervious asphalt instead of impervious asphalt for all of the repaving and all of the development projects that are going on throughout the county?
And so I take it pervious asphalt would soak up the water or filter it through?
Soak it up. It allows it to go through and to sink into the aquifer rather than to spill off and go into the streams and create the runoff problem that we've been talking about.
I think that's a good question to start off with, Mr. Rozelle, and then I'd like to shoot it back to Rusty, and then shoot it back to you about the cost of that and what that would take.
Pervious asphalt works well when it's clean, but all you got to do is put a little mud on it, some of that good red mud that we have here in Mecklenburg County that is very, very fine and very, very small, and then it doesn't work anymore. Because the pores clog up. So our biggest concern has always been that if we count on that as a solution, then we got to count on people keeping it clean. And that is a hard pill to swallow. And so that's the problem with pervious asphalt. If we had it, it was kept clean, people made sure that it worked right, it would be a good thing. But does anybody in this room really believe that's going to happen? I don't think so. So that's always something that kind of bothers us. Browns Cove, we're still working to figure that one out.
You may want to say where that is.
Browns Cove is a cove off of Lake Wiley, south of I-85. It's in Mecklenburg County. In the, what a lot of you may know is the Steel Creek community. It's not too far from I-485. And a lot of construction at the airport. There's been a lot of construction, that intermodal center at the airport. There's been a lot of commercial development that's occurred in the area that drains to Browns Cove, and a lot of residential development that drains to Browns Cove. And most of the sediment that's ended up in Browns Cove is a result of poor erosion control during construction. Some of that was at the airport. Some of it was at these other private developments that have occurred. And some of it was the construction of I-485. So imagine yourself, you own a nice little lot on the lake, and one day you wake up and your water is 8 inches shallower when it was only 2 feet deep to begin with. And it happened because some, you know, mud's washed in from upstream. The people are very upset, and we're trying to work towards, number one, removing the sediment from the cove and preventing additional sediment from entering the cove. But I don't think pervious pavement would have protected us from that. But I don't disagree with you in that it can be effective if it's done right.
And if we have more street cleaning, I don't see a whole bunch of street cleaning.
No,
going
it's
Charlotte-Mecklenburg.
I think the thing on the coastal plain, you got much larger particles of soil, the sands that don't clog these devices so quickly, they really work much better. But anybody from Mecklenburg County that's familiar with our very fine red clays around here, it is tough on the pervious pavement.
Now, Mr. Padilla, from a development standpoint, a building standpoint, how does cost figure into that? Do you know whether that's more expensive or cheaper?
Pervious pavement specifically? Mm-hmm. It's going to be more expensive. And I think most of the technologies that, you know, as Rusty said, technologies are out there that if you were to go back, for example, and retrofit a lot of properties out there that are not currently in compliance with stormwater that were built back in the 70s, you're talking billions. And I think the issue here is one of who pays and how do we absorb that cost without making Mecklenburg County unaffordable? How do we absorb that cost without making that next family that moves in here and is making below the median income, household income, to say, well, I've got a job near downtown or I've got a job near university, but I can't afford to live there. So I'm now going to have to live in Iredell, or I'm going to have to live in Cabarrus or in Union, and I'm going to have to drive in. And now we're putting a different stress on our environment. We're putting a stress from vehicular travel, and we're putting a stress from air quality. So there is a balance that we've got to figure out how to achieve, and I think we're always trying to figure that out. And it, you know, as Rick and I have talked about before, I think everyone on our side of the world thinks that the regulation is way too strict, and I know most folks on your side think it's not enough. Somewhere in the middle, there's a balance that works, but we have to keep in mind, what are the other priorities? How do we do that without running housing out of Mecklenburg County, running families out of Mecklenburg County, and running jobs out as well?
Now, Mr. Gaskins, as you said before, may say, well, you know, you can buy, you can make cheaper units if that's, you know, by doing more high-density stuff. I mean, what's...
Well, no, he's right. I mean, I think generally you're seeing buyer preferences move in that direction. But keep in mind, density and height, when you go to a higher density product, there's more cost involved in that. Steel construction versus wood construction, that is absolutely where the market's going. I think we still need to incentivize it, though, because the reality is, as he said, and a great point, the zoning code doesn't exactly open the door for that right now. You have a zoning code that's very antiquated. We have a zoning code that encourages low-density, single-use development, which is not where I think most of our market wants to go. If you want to build something that's mixed use, that's walkable, you have to get variances. You have to go through loops and a significantly more complex entitlement process to do that. So our current set of regulations isn't really set to incentivize that, and we've got to figure out how. And I think to their credit, particularly the city of Charlotte, is looking at ways to do that, looking at ways especially to encourage and incentivize redevelopment instead of greenfield development. But we've still got a ways to go.
And when you say greenfield development, that's taking a plot of land that has not been developed, really.
Right. New development.
And redeveloping.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Do we have another question out there? Yep.
Hi, and thank you, WFAE. I'm a longtime listener, and just a wonderful opportunity here to talk here tonight. Lisa, for moderating, Catawba Riverkeeper, and the City of Charlotte, thank you for coming to this very important event. Mr. Gullett, most of my questions are directed towards you, sir. And it's important that we talk about not only what's in our water, but what's not in our water. And the City of Charlotte actually does a very good job cleaning the water before they put it back after it's been used. And what they do is it goes through a waste treatment plant, you dewater it, you turn it into sludge, and then you take that sludge and you truck it out of the city, mostly into South Carolina, and you land apply it on farm fields. And we have, very recently, we had a permit that was just renewed for the City of Charlotte. And in that permit, there was over 450 people participated in that, including the Riverkeeper. Of that population, I'd say probably 60 to 70% were opposed to that permit. Permit was still approved. And so this has been a long-going process with the city. And the city sludge has recently been in the news, again, with PCBs. And that's a real problem. And we're very concerned about that. Specifically because what happened was DHEC passed emergency regulation in September 2013. I think it was actually September 23rd, 2013. The City of Charlotte did a test for PCBs, I believe, October 1st, 2013. So it was about an 11-day difference. And between the last spread event that you had in a community that really doesn't want you there, there was about 11 days between the two events. And is the city basically saying that PCBs were never applied to farm fields where everybody's food here in this audience? Where this food was grown? Are you here sitting here tonight to say that PCBs were not land applied anywhere in South Carolina?
Well, let me tell you what I can say about that. The testing that you're talking about that occurred last fall was prompted by an illegal dumping episode that happened in Greenville and Spartanburg, South Carolina. And upon that illegal dumping, everybody was put on alert. All wastewater treatment plants in the region were put on alert to be aware that this possibility is out there, that there might be additional illegal dumping that had taken place. So we all began testing for PCBs. We also stopped land applying in South Carolina because DHEC, the actual regulations do allow for a small concentration of PCBs to be in biosolids, which is the sludge, that is land applied. We don't believe that we applied any sludge anywhere that exceeded that number. And we don't believe that we applied any sludge in South Carolina that had PCBs in it. Now, can I prove that? Absolutely, to your satisfaction. I think we've had this discussion before. And so that's it's an ongoing discussion within the community. So I can't give you a 100% definitive answer to that question. I can tell you that to the best of our knowledge, we didn't land apply biosolids that had PCBs in them in South Carolina or North Carolina.
If it's found, $1.3 million,
I think the $1.3 million that you're talking about came from a newspaper story that ran a week or so ago.
What is the $1.3 million, by the way?
The $1.3 million is let me back up just a minute. Most of you probably know, but there was an illegal dumping incident that happened in February in Charlotte where PCBs are a banned substance. They've been banned for manufacture or importation in the U.S. since 1979, but there's still a lot of them out in the world in use. They're in some electrical transformers. They're in a lot of industrial equipment. They were very, very widely used for many, many years. So there's still a lot of it out there. But it's expensive to dispose of it properly. So the temptation is to dispose of it improperly. And in the case of the incident that happened in February, someone discharged illegally probably a tanker full of material containing PCBs into the sanitary sewer system, and it went into one of the wastewater treatment plants. And so what happens is the wastewater treatment plant can actually deal with PCBs fairly well because they're not very water soluble. But what they do is they stick to the dirt, they stick to the solids, they stick to the fats and the oils and the grease that are in a wastewater treatment plant. And so they are removed and separated during the treatment process, and they come out of the plant in the biosolids or in the sludge. I remind people all the time, treatment plants, whether they be water plants or wastewater plants, are not magic. They don't make anything disappear. What they do is they separate things. And in some cases, you can take things that were harmful, and you can break those things down and treat them and make them unharmful, and then you dispose of them in the most beneficial way. PCBs don't biodegrade in any kind of reasonable time frame. They're very, very stable. That was one of the things that made them attractive for industrial use, is they don't change. They stay like they are. So the wastewater treatment plant did a very good job of removing, separating the PCBs from the water, but then they show up in the biosolids, in the sludge. And so we have been collecting that material now at the treatment plants where we detected it. It's still there, still at the treatment plants, hasn't left. And so we're collecting it and storing it and making arrangements to dispose of it properly. And some of that will have to go to a hazardous waste landfill in Alabama. It will be very, very costly. The $1.3 million does not cover the cost of hauling it off. That $1.3 million covered emergency response work that we had to do for the first few weeks of that illegal dumping incident. It covered contracts with hazardous waste experts, with consultants, with companies that we had in the treatment plant that were skimming material off of ponds, off of the treatment units, off of cleaning pipes, cleaning equipment, providing Tyvek suits for our operators who had to suit up to work in that environment. So that's what the $1.3 million was for. There's going to be more contracts coming that will be even more than that. And this is a cost that the community is going to have to bear. That's because as was described earlier, we get our revenue to operate the water and sewer system only from water and sewer bills that are sent out. That's the only source of revenue that we have. And so no tax dollars go into the operation of the water and sewer utility. So that is a cost that we're going to have to bear to properly dispose of that material.
So what you're saying is then as soon as CMUD determined that there were PCBs going into the water system, into the wastewater system, that sludge was not then taken to South Carolina and none of that was used.
That's correct. It hasn't been taken
as
anywhere.
Far
it's still
as
there.
Know. Yeah.
Can I elaborate on one other point related to this?
Mm-hmm.
CMUD in many respects is just an amazingly well-run system. And what most people are unaware of is a lot of sewage in this region isn't handled through well-managed public systems, both because some public systems aren't well-managed, but also because in many cases the area has grown so quickly that development has outpaced the infrastructure. And we have a lot of development, particularly around the lakes, that are dependent on what are called package treatment plants. I call them the mobile home of sewage treatment. They're basically come in on a flatbed truck, you plop them out there, there's not a human being there to operate them. And if they had encountered these kind of problems that CMUD encountered with the PCBs, it would have passed through and nobody would have ever known it because there wouldn't have been a human being there to notice it.
And it was a human being that caught the PCB dumpings.
Yes, absolutely.
And so I really want to emphasize it emphasizes the importance of a well-run system with human beings there 24 hours a day to notice the subtle things that indicate there's something weird going on here and we better check it out. But there are literally hundreds of package treatment plants out there discharging into our creeks all the time. When we test them, most of the time they are in violation. They are discharging in excess of their limits because there's not a human being there to monitor them and be able to tell whether they're working right.
And I want to elaborate just a little bit on that. There has been tremendous progress in Mecklenburg County in terms of cleaning up streams and the environment in the last 50 years. And I think, Rusty hasn't been here quite 50 years, but...
Not so, well.
He's working on it, though. Yeah. He doesn't have far to go. So,
neither do you, Barry.
Well, yeah, we won't talk about that. But the my point is that that process of cleaning up the environment has been very deliberate, and it's something that the community has invested a lot of money in, and I think it's paid off. And I think it's something that continues to need additional investment going forward. It needs investment, like Rusty and Rick and Joe have all said. It needs investment in the stormwater system. It needs investment in the water system. It needs investment in the wastewater system. So maybe next time we can completely fill the hole up in Rick's front yard. So
it's treating my stormwater.
So the point is that if you go back 50 years, there was a proliferation, maybe not 50 years, but even 25 years ago, there was a proliferation. I can't say the word. There were a lot of packaged wastewater treatment plants in Mecklenburg County. There were probably, what would you say, Rusty? 50, 100, something like that? There were a lot. Yeah. How many are out there today?
It's probably about 15.
About 15. Yeah. And so what happened to those wastewater treatment plants is they were serving neighborhoods. They were serving neighborhoods that a lot of us lived in. And that's the thing that can't go unsaid in this, is that all of these things that we're talking about here are not the result of a pipe, and they're not the result of a road, and they're not the result of a building. They're the result of people, okay? And there are places where we all visit, where we all live, where we all work, where we all play. But we've got to be willing to take care of that environment. And so what happened in those days was that the development got ahead of the infrastructure. And so there wasn't an investment in public sewers or public water systems in a lot of the areas where there was tremendous pressure to build houses and to build businesses. And so those houses and businesses were built, and these packaged treatment plants served as a way of providing sanitary sewer service. And they worked okay, maybe, for a little while, and then they didn't. And so then what happened was that there was a public investment to come and take those packaged plants out. And that's been one of the things that Charlotte-Mecklenburg Utility Department, the regionalization and consolidation of Charlotte's water system and wastewater system with the systems that were in place in Mecklenburg County, that were in place with the other six towns in Mecklenburg County, that work, that really good work that was done by our predecessors, the previous generation, really, of city officials, elected officials, managers, has really allowed us to remove those packaged treatment plants. It's allowed us to not have to hang barrels of deodorant under bridges to keep creeks from smelling so bad. It's allowed us.
That's
that
my
was,
story, Barry.
I know. I had to steal it before you got there. I've heard it a lot of times. Yeah. I've seen the pictures. Rick was talking about the pictures earlier. 1961? Is that what you said?
69.
69. Yeah. Okay. 1969, Sugar Creek. Is that the creek?
Yeah.
Down close to where the Metropolitan is,
yep,
right now.
Where there's now a lovely greenway.
Yeah, where there's a lovely greenway, where the creek looks, most of the time, looks pretty good.
Yep.
But in those days, it didn't look good at all.
No.
And in fact, it stunk so bad they had to hang barrels of deodorant under the bridges for anybody to be around it. So it's not like there hasn't been progress. There's been a ton of progress. Is there room for more? Absolutely there's room for more. And we all need to be very diligent about staying after that and making it better.
And it's interesting that it was a sort of local regional effort as opposed to maybe even a state effort. But we'll circle back to the regulation of that as well. I want to get to more questions because I know our time is ticking away. So I'd like to hear from you over here. Could you introduce yourself?
Thank you. I'm Alan Barnhart, and I live in the Freedom Park Neighborhood Association. We're right down from that wonderful bridge you were talking about. Freedom Park, as you probably know, is one of our best parks that we've got, and it sees people there all the time, especially in the weekend. Oh, that was one of those places that was really nasty, and in fact, I think there was hydrogen peroxide in there probably within the last 20 years that we were putting in. I think that was what was in those big tanks. It's been cleaned up, and that's nice. It's really good to see that, but I'm hearing a lot about prevention, you know, and keeping our water quality better instead of trying to cure it and treat it later. I believe in prevention over the cure. So my question really comes to, what are we doing to try to preserve some of these areas? You know, we're talking about building out infill housing, putting people closer into the city. And I look around my neighborhood and I see a piece of property that used to have one house and now it has nine. And that property, one lot on that piece of property that was developed, is sending a lot of dirt 2 yards over into my backyard. And I'm going like, silt fences, sure, not working. And so, you know, what are we talking about? How are we going to correct some of these issues? If we've got greenway space, if we've got floodplain that is now being developed, and it is in my neighborhood, what are we doing to preserve some of that as buffer zones? Because the 35-foot buffer zone is not adequate in most spaces. We need more space to absorb a bunch of this stuff. We need to do something if we really want to incentivize people to keep it. You either need to give them credits for the green space that they're using, or you're going to have to charge the people for their hardening surfaces. And I can take you in my neighborhood and show you a lot of hardened surfaces that have happened within the past 5 years. And those people are building huge houses. And the percentage of the property that's going hard surface is going up. So these people, they don't care about what's going in the river. I hate to say it. We are all going to pay for it at some point down the road.
Now, and you know, these are individuals building these big homes, it sounds like, in your area. And you know, the county does charge for how it works with stormwater, is that it charges for the amount of impervious surface you have. So the idea is, right, if you have a bigger amount of concrete on your area, that you are paying more. Now, I mean, is that sufficient? Is that the right balance? But this actually might be a good question for you to take, Mr. Padilla, since you are, you know, as representing groups who work very closely with these regulations. What do we have in place? Is it incentivizing the right things? I mean, how do you incentivize conservation and smart building practices? And if you could use a specific example, that would be great.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we talk about infill and redevelopment, not every area of Mecklenburg County and Charlotte is going to be appropriate for high-density infill development. And I think, you know, I give planning department in Charlotte and in the towns a lot of credit for looking at plans that really identify where that kind of redevelopment needs to happen. It really needs to happen where infrastructure is in place to accommodate it. And to Rick's point earlier, we don't have a zoning code right now that incentivizes that. Now, in terms of, you know, the hard surface and the runoff, you know, there is – silt fence is intended and designed, at least – based on the other prevailing technologies that are out there, to be an effective tool to mitigate that. Very often people will show me a photo of you know, groundwater coming into a creek. You can always trace it back to a failed silt fence, a poorly installed implement of some sort of best management practice that should have been implemented, should have been caught, enforcement should have been better on it. So there's a difference between the level of regulation we have and the level of enforcement we have. And in a lot of cases, the regulation may be sufficient, but the enforcement and the compliance is not. And that's a funding mechanism. That's something where we need to be sure that we have dollars coming into county and city government to be able to fund that, you know, those departments. Unfortunately, right now, in a lot of ways, most of these functions are completely funded based on user fees. What Mecklenburg County has called Land Use and Environmental Services, LUISA as we call it, is pretty much fee-funded. It means when development is going great and we have tons of permits being issued, they have lots of money to hire lots of staff and lots of, you know, people going out there to make sure that new home construction and any type of development is being enforced properly. When permits go down, and we just went through a period when they not only went down, they fell off a cliff, you don't have that. Staff gets laid off. Staff has to be cut. And that doesn't mean, however, that the issue or the need for enforcement has gone away. There may still be construction going. There is still construction going on. There are still other issues that we need that staff for. And unfortunately, we don't have a funding mechanism in place today where general fund dollars go to a department like that to make sure we can keep an even level of staff in there to enforce even in downtime. So that's one issue I think we need to look at. Who is going to pay for the enforcement and staff when you have a downturn and you can't just go and take fees up on new construction?
So you're saying not as strong enforcement as led many developers, builders to some developers and builders to kind of flout some of the regulations in place.
Well, I mean,
and when you're talking about urban redevelopment, specifically, what would be a fair incentive to offer to redevelop a piece of land?
Well, we're talking right now, and we have a program that we hope the city will renew or at least continue for a while with the Post-Construction Controls Ordinance, the PCCO, another acronym I'll throw out. That is basically the ordinance that regulates, and Rusty may have alluded to it earlier, what is put on a site to ensure that post-construction, post-development, all of the runoff from that site is being controlled for velocity and for cleanliness. So you have it go into generally what we call a wet pond or a dry pond on-site. Those ponds take up a good bit of area, and then it's drained through to a creek after it's been cleaned and in some ways mitigated of pollutants. When you're looking at redevelopment, though, those ponds can be very difficult to put on. When you have a one-acre site, especially in an urban location, there's nowhere on that site to put a pond, plus all the required parking, plus the footprint of the building. So very often those ponds go underground. Now that creates an entirely different level of challenge. There's $400,000 to $500,000 very often to put a pond underground. You also have maintenance, long-term maintenance costs on it. So it's something that I think we've had very good dialogue with the city on how do you incentivize people, give them an alternative means of compliance. And there is a program right now that they're looking at that's been in place for 3 years. The city staff, stormwater staff, has been very pleased with the amount of dollars it's raised in terms of allowing someone who does a redevelopment anywhere in the city to say, if I can't find a way to economically make that pond work, I can give dollars to the city in which they'll go out and do a public improvement offsite. Now,
and that's not as good of a quality.
Here's the picture we have to look at. Do we go after, in every case, the most ideal, perfect on-site situation, or do we try to keep, do we want to take a vacant piece of property and try to redevelop it and have, in many ways, we're still improving it, because that vacant piece of property, if it's 100% impervious today, when it's redeveloped, even without a single post-construction stormwater facility on site, you're putting in trees that the previous development did not have, because tree ordinance requires it. You're putting in, just by the very nature of redeveloping it, you're putting in less impervious surface than what's more than likely there today. You're getting an economically dead site, and you're creating tax revenue. You're creating jobs. You're keeping development or that development from going further out. So there are a lot of benefits to it. Now, no one is by any means saying that there should be no compliance whatsoever with stormwater. But if there is a way, if there's some flexibility that we can provide, and I think the city does right now have a program that does that, isn't that what we want to have in our system, that level of flexibility where you can try to strike that balance on a site-by-site basis and not have regulation that's so stringent that developer is going to say, you know what, I just can't afford to do business in Mecklenburg County. I'm going to go to Iredell. I'm going to go to Cabarrus. I'm going to go to York across the state line. They may not have the regulations that Mecklenburg does, and quite frankly, most of them don't, and that becomes more economically viable and more economically reliable than doing a project here, and we just continue to march outward with our growth.
Now, I again, our clock is ticking down, so I want to see how many folks out there have questions right now. We have a lot of questions, and we have about 20 minutes, so what I'm going to ask you to do is, please ask your question, make sure it's succinct. And all of you folks up here, if you can give a pretty brief response so we can fit as many questions and answers as we can. So first up there, please.
Hi, my name is Peter Fulton, and I live on Mountain Island Lake, right outside McDowell Creek. Probably fish the lake close to 100 days a year. And going back about 5 years ago, we read an article, a couple articles in the Charlotte Observer that talked about how clean that water was on Mountain Island Lake. If not, I think they said it was the second cleanest lake in the state of North Carolina. And now we fast forward to the last several months, even prior to the coal ash, it became one of the most polluted lakes or the dirtiest water in North Carolina. How can that be? We, you know, our neighbors and myself were sort of scratching our head. 5 years ago, they say this. 5 years ago, now it's not clean. And so we're not really sure who to believe.
Sure, and there's different measures of cleanliness, different ways you can look at what's in a lake. But, yeah, Rusty, why don't you take that?
Okay. The lake and the quality of the water in the lake is excellent. It has degraded very little. We've been measuring the water quality in that lake for close to 50 years. We've got all this data, and we've tracked it, and it has degraded. You can't measure it. It's basically as clean as it was 50 years ago. But what you're reading in the paper is that it's the most threatened, not most polluted, most threatened. And there's a huge difference between that. I mean, I think there are a lot of pressures on Mountain Island Lake, the coal ash basin being one of them, and there are other things that cause us concern. But these things are threats, not actual pollution problems. So the lake is clean.
But I do want to clarify, there are some problems.
There are problems.
I mean, it is a very clean lake, but we do know, for example, in the cove where you have all the coal ash seepage, I wouldn't be catching fish in that area, probably. We do know higher concentrations of things like arsenic over there. We do know there are fish with PCBs in Mountain Island Lake. Where that came from is frankly still unclear. But I would agree with Rusty, and probably Barry would agree too, that in general, the lake water quality, the ambient water quality in the main part of the lake is generally good. But it could be better. And there's certainly a big risk. I mean, that's really what the attention is on the coal ash problem, is what happens if we have a catastrophic failure.
All right.
My name is Judy Lynn. I am deeply disturbed that Duke Energy was allowed to amass these coal ash ponds, basins, whatever you want to call them.
And I should just say real quickly, we did ask Duke Energy and we asked the state's Department of Environment and Natural Resources to come today, and they said they weren't able to supply someone. So with that said, please go ahead.
So I have two questions. One is to Richard. What can we do about this problem that we have allowed to develop and has become greater and greater and threatens Mountain Island Lake so severely? And to CMUD, what are you going to do about this threat that the state has allowed to develop, continue, and that will be a real problem for you if that seepage or a break were to occur?
I'll take the first part and turn it over to Barry. I think the biggest thing you can do is call up your state legislator. There are drafts out, I understand, of at least 5 coal ash bills in the legislature. Frankly, this happened back in 2008, actually 2009, after the coal ash bill in Tennessee in 2008. The legislature was prepared to introduce some legislation at that time, and frankly, public interest disappeared. People's attention went to other issues. They didn't feel the pressure anymore, and they never passed the bills to tighten the regulations on coal ash. So I think here we can't do the usual thing we, the public, do, which is kind of focus on an issue for a few weeks, say that's really bad, and then move on to a different issue. Is we really got to let our legislators know, we want you to follow through this time. Don't start something and not finish it. Give us some real bills that are really going to protect the environment and make a difference. And basically what that means is put in deadlines and put in requirements to say we want the ash to get away from the water, and it ought to be in a lined facility, not in an unlined leaking pit next to our drinking water. And I'll turn it over to Barry.
Let me just respond by saying this. I think the picture on the screen right now is actually the Dan River
It is, indeed.
The Dan River facility.
It is.
So don't anybody get confused. That's not Mountain Island Lake. But I want to point out a couple of differences. The first is that what you're looking at there is a river, not a lake. Certainly, if there were a massive failure of the coal ash ponds at River Bend, it would be an environmental disaster. Certainly, there's nobody that would argue otherwise. The likelihood of that happening, I don't know. The good news is, if there is any good news in this, and I'm not implying there is, but if there is that if you go to the Dan River site and you look at the lessons learned up there, we've sent folks up to the Dan City of Danville's water treatment plant is a few miles downstream of the facility that's on the screen there, and was receiving the water that had the coal ash in it as their raw water source. We've sent folks up to that, some of our staff, we've sent them up there to talk to the people in the treatment plant and to ask them how it worked, how did they treat it, was it treatable, what was the quality of the water that they were able to produce, what kind of side effects did they see, what was the impact on the residual material that the water plant produced. Water plants produce a sludge also. This the dirt that comes out of the water. And so what we learned in that was that the city of Danville was in fact able to treat the water, and they produced water that met or exceeded those minimum water quality standards that were produced. So if there was any encouragement out of this, it was that the water was still treatable. Like I said earlier, water treatment plants are designed to take bad things out of the water, and they were able to deal with the coal ash.
But Duke Energy's coal ash ponds are so much larger. So, I mean, would we have a chance of being able to?
Larger and closer.
It's a good question, and it's a hypothetical question. The coal ash ponds have been there for 50 years or longer. So it's not a new problem. It's a threat that's been there. Rusty talked about threats. It's a threat that's been there for a long time. And so it's being dealt with. And so that's the good news. If it did fail, it would absolutely be, a bad thing. Would it impact our drinking water? We can't say for 100% certain that it wouldn't. What we can say is that in the Dan River incident, the Danville water treatment plant was able to still treat it and was still able to produce drinking water.
And what you're seeing on the screen, by the way, that was the Dan River and the plant right there. And now you're seeing 20 miles downstream the coal ash spill, what it looked like. Any other? Let's go over here.
Hello, my name is Hollis Parks, and I'm an environmental educator for Mecklenburg County. I'm not here under Mecklenburg County, however.
And real quick, I'm sorry to stop you, but I'm just curious, as far as the audience is concerned, how many folks in here would consider them environmental activists? Got a few of you. Anyone from the building industry, development industry? Okay, all right. Anyone in the water industries? Good. I'm glad you raised your hand. Okay, I'm sorry. Go on.
Oh, no problem at all. And the reason why I came tonight is because I am responsible for teaching the public about what you guys are doing here in Mecklenburg County. And I was wondering, how would you handle the question, which I receive quite often, of we have a river that is in the top 15 most endangered rivers in the United States consistently, at least over the past decade or so. You have a river that has a coal ash pond that has higher elevated levels of arsenic, mercury, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and then we get our drinking water out of Mountain Island Lake off of Pump Station Road. And then I get asked, the follow-up question is, what risk do we have? And then I ask, how are we treating our water? And then what are we adding into it on the back end, whether it be fluoride or aluminum or alum or whatever, to make it more palatable or make it better for the public and to treat microbes, et cetera. And so that's the question I always get, and I've taken tours of our water system here just so I can answer that question better, and I was hoping I could get the experts' opinions of that. And how would you answer those questions?
Sure, and by endangered, that's also a measure of how much water is taken out of the river, not necessarily how polluted it actually is.
There's a lot that goes into that,
yeah.
But when they say there's a lot of threats, but the water quality is still
sure.
pretty good. you know, we always, of course, educate that. We're like, yes, the river is threatened. However, the water quality in Mount Island Lake is still pretty good comparatively. So how would you answer the other questions, though, of how do we treat it and how are we mitigating those risks?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Gullett, back to you.
Okay. Let me see if I can do this concisely. I know I could spend the rest of the night talking about it, but probably wouldn't be anybody left to listen. Drinking water treatment is a well-understood, well-established science. And as I said earlier, drinking water treatment plants can deal with a wide variety of raw water quality coming in. The things that we add to the drinking water, we try to keep to a minimum. Everything that you put in water reacts with other things that are in the water. And so we try not to put anything in there that we don't have to or that isn't there for a particular reason. So the water treatment process, there's a physical part and there's a chemical part. And so the physical part, and they're interrelated. So the physical part is the filtration. It's removing the big particles. It's removing the chunks of 2x4 that are in the floating in the water sometimes in the river. It's removing the particles. And then the chemical part is primarily the disinfection, but also it's causing the harmful particles in the water the dirt particles in the water to consolidate, to stick together, to bind up other things that are dissolved in the water. Someone mentioned earlier that things like to stick to clay, and that's what's in our water primarily is clay, is sediment. And so we've got to get that out. So that's essentially the process. It's physical, it's chemical, it's disinfection, and it works. It works in Charlotte. It works in cities all across the world. It's very proven, very dependable, very reliable process.
I think CMUD system is amazing, and I encourage you, there's a Blue Planet display up at the water treatment plant just south of Lake Norman off of Highway 73. It's a great explanation of the process. Unfortunately, most of the small towns in this region can't afford to do the same things you do here in Charlotte. And so, I'm not sure people who might hear this later who might not live in Charlotte should be quite as reassured about the ability to get out, particularly chemicals other than, things other than bacteria and things like that. Some of them are much less able to treat for chemical waste.
Every year we publish a water quality report. Up until last year, it was actually mailed through the Postal Service to all of the customers in Mecklenburg County. Last year, we were allowed to not mail it, but just to notify people that it's available, and it's posted on our website. So you can go to the charmec.org website, and you can get to it, and it will show you everything that we detected in the drinking water last year, in the previous year. And there will also be a list of things that we tested for but did not detect. And so that's an important part of it, too, is what did we not find, which is probably just as important, if not more important, than what we did find. The other thing that I would point out when you're looking at that is to look at units of measurement. The science of measurement has gotten so precise and so sensitive that we're now looking and commonly measuring pollutants in water at the parts per billion level. If you think about that, if I'm not mistaken, the population of the world is 7-point-something billion people. Okay, so when we're talking about looking for something at a concentration of one part per billion, we're talking about looking for 7 people on the face of the earth. That's the level of testing that's going on our drinking water. And as I said earlier, we conduct over 150,000 analyses every year on the drinking water. So we have to and want to and will continue to treat it with the best technology and the best processes, and then to monitor it and measure it to ensure that what we're delivering and what's coming out of your faucet meets all of those requirements and exceeds those requirements in every case that we can.
Now we have 5 more minutes. I'd love to get 2 more questions in. So please, over here on this side of the room.
Hello, I'm Henry Shainhoff. Quick question. So we're talking about threats to our water supply, right? Mentioned the PCBs being dumped into our sewer system. You know, when we think of acts of terrorism, I think something that we kind of fail to think about is somebody right now could really do a lot of damage to our city if they just went to one of our water intakes. And just kind of wanted to get y'all your thoughts on that note.
So, I think this is a question for you, Mr. Gullett, Rusty. You know, Mountain Island Lake, Lake Norman, anyone can get to them. I mean, we have plenty of people boating on them. So, you know, should we have more security at these lakes?
That is a really good question. I will say that everybody's opinion has changed a number of times about the safety and security of water systems. 9/11 was a wake-up call for the whole world. A lot of incidents that have happened since then have illustrated various threats and risks that are out there. We've conducted vulnerability assessments, and we'll continue to conduct vulnerability assessments. And we will work with the experts in security to do everything that we can to mitigate it. We don't talk a whole lot about what we're doing because we really don't want a lot of people to know what we're doing on the security side, because that would expose vulnerabilities, and we don't want to do that.
All right.
Hi, my name's Karen Aker, and a lot of people are attracted to Charlotte because it's a beautiful place and we have these wonderful greenways and things. And I was noticing that the greenway down by Ray Road and Piper Glen, the 4 Mile Creek, it seems to be flooding and the water isn't draining off and the trees are dying in spots, a lot of dying. And I was wondering, is that affected? Are the greenways affected by the stormwater runoff?
They can be. Most of the greenways are along creek banks and in floodplains, and that's by design. And so that does certainly, stormwater runoff and flooding can affect the usability of the greenway and the creek and the trees or whatever vegetation may be on the greenway. But and I got to say this. I've been quiet for a long time. It's getting me pretty nervous up here. But we talked a lot about drinking water, and Charlotte-Mecklenburg Utilities, of course, is responsible for treating our drinking water and providing it to us and treating our wastewater. And then back at the beginning of the conversation, we talked a lot about stormwater. So I wanted to bring it back a little bit to stormwater and say that there is a second utility in Mecklenburg County. It's called Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Services, and when you pay your water and sewer bill, you also pay a stormwater fee. And I just wanted to say that the work that we do to protect water quality is funded 100% by that stormwater fee.
And much of the work you do is you do monitoring for the EPA.
We monitor
as well.
I mean, Barry mentioned how many parameters they. In a given year, we run 250,000 analyses on the surface waters in our streams and lakes. We've got by far and away, unquestionably, probably the best water quality program, very unique program, certainly in the state, if not the southeast. And we're doing a lot of proactive things to try to address this big problem I talked about earlier. Like we mentioned the greenway, the new greenway system in Little Sugar Creek at the mall up there. What's the name of that mall?
Metropolitan.
That was paid for through Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Services and the stormwater fee in conjunction with grants. We're also removing houses that were built in the 60s and 70s from the floodplain. And we are we're removing those houses, we're paying the people for the homes, we're using stormwater fees along with FEMA grants, we're pulling the houses out, we're moving, paying the people for the homes, they're able to move outside of the floodplain, we're eliminating that risk, and then we go in there and we put in water quality features to treat the stormwater and remove the pollutants with these basins we talked about earlier. And then we're putting greenways there. And then we go in and we restore the stream channel to eliminate those straight cutaway banks and the destruction of the habitat from the increased volume and velocity. And we're doing that all over the city, and the city of Charlotte has a long list of projects that they work on to try to reduce flooding problems from undersized pipes all over the city for the past 100 years. I think the real difficulty in this is, whereas the utility was started in 1972, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Utilities, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Service was established in 1993. So we've got a lot of work to do a lot of work to do, and we've got a lot of catching up to do, but I'm confident that we'll do that, and I look for great things in the future.
Does that answer your question?
Can I respond to one more point on that question? An issue that we've had a lot from, particularly in the west side of Charlotte, is a lot of the community gardens are down in the floodplains. Mm-hmm. And what's the impact when you have a flood event on the community gardens? And, you know, I think, you know, from the testing we've done, there does seem to be some measurable impact. When you have these flood events, they tend to have pollutants associated with them. And I certainly, you know, on the leafy vegetables, the things that you're going to, particularly things like lettuce, I would sure want to wash it really, really, really well if it came out of one of those areas that gets flooding.
Well, thanks so much, everyone, for joining us, for our panel tonight, for coming.
Can I say one more thing real quickly before we wrap up?
You can.
At the beginning of this, there was a question on the screen, and the question on the screen was, what's in your water? And I've been waiting all night to answer that question.
Let's hear it.
Well, one of the audience asked it from a chemical perspective, but I want to answer it from a different perspective. What I see in your water is health. How healthy will you be if you don't drink the water? What I see in your water is life. What I see in the water is safety from a firefighting perspective, from a hygiene perspective. What I see in the water is economic sustainability and viability. How many industries and businesses would be in Charlotte if there were no water? So I see water from a different perspective. I also see value in water. Does anybody know what a gallon of water costs if you get it out of your spigot? Anybody? It costs 0.3 of 1 penny. 0.3 of 1 penny for a gallon of water. For a full penny, we'll deliver it anytime you want it, day or night. You can use it, put it back in the drain. We'll take it back, clean it up, make it cleaner than it was when we took it out, and put it back in the creek.
So you are actually saying your water is cheaper than bottled water.
Oh, way, way by far. By far. By far.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Let's give the panel a round of applause. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. And I know there are several of you who still had questions. We'd love to hear from you. You can hear the audio from tonight's forum at our website. That should be up sometime tomorrow. And we'd love to keep track of you, watch your email. If you gave us your email address, we'd love to hear your thoughts about the forum tonight, places we could improve, things we're doing well. And to keep the conversation going, you can visit us on Facebook, Twitter. We have an Instagram account, too. So thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.